Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Full EV or plug-in hybrid? Go electric with Kia. For more, log on to kia.com.
1850-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551, wash your hands, is our text number. Now, all week we've been hearing from family members of the men involved, and they were all men, primarily in the 1970 arms trial. One family we haven't yet heard from is that of a central character in the saga, then the Minister for Defence, Jim Gibbons, who was the chief prosecution witness against Charles Haughey and Neil Blaney never got to trial, against Charles Haughey, Captain James Kelly and John Kelly. The daughter of Jim Gibbons is Elizabeth Gibbons. Elizabeth Gibbons, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
You are the daughter of Jim Gibbons, Minister for Defence, in 1970 at the heart of the arms trial. And as the judge said in the arms trial, Mr. Justice Henchy said in the summing up, "I would like to be able to suggest some way you can avoid holding there is perjury in this case.
Mm-hmm.
There is a flat contradiction between Mr. Haughey's version and Mr. Gibbons' version." Mr. Haughey was Minister for Finance and Mr. Gibbons was Minister for Defence in the same government. "And the difference seems to be irreconcilable."
Yes.
Now, isn't that at the heart of...
Yes.
And the fact that Mr. Haughey was then acquitted and his co-defendants
mm-hmm.
meant that the inference was that your dad had been less than truthful.
Yeah, well, I don't accept that, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
It was a conspiracy trial, and it was never going to be one that was easy to prove one way or the other. And
yeah.
So that wasn't really what was going to happen. And all I can say about the trial, it was a very, very difficult experience.
Yeah.
Even in the trial itself, and I didn't really know that we'd get into that, but the
mm-hmm.
trial itself, my father was a lone figure there. All of the other people that were involved had teams of the highest experts, law
mm-hmm.
experts in the land supporting them. My father had none of that.
Okay.
He had nobody supporting him. He was on his own. He was grilled for hours and hours by these people.
Mm-hmm.
With zero support.
Wow.
It was an absolutely horrific experience. The support he had was with family returning home and very, very close friends.
Mm-hmm.
After that now, it was thin on the ground.
And what about cabinet colleagues who would have supported his line and Jack Lynch's line?
Yeah, he had close friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the details of who actually supported him, except that he felt very lonely and isolated at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There were people, of course, who he was particularly close to, like George Colley, and
mm-hmm.
one who was particularly supportive was David Andrews.
Okay.
It's always difficult in a situation like
mm-hmm.
that. I see it because even in my own work, you see situations where, whether it's power or bullying or whatever, or situations arise. Sometimes when you're the victim of that, other people retreat into the background when the going gets tough.
And was Jack Lynch, the Taoiseach, supportive of...
Jack was always supportive, but he had to support the government first and foremost, and they had their own prosecution lawyer, I suppose, at the trial. Jack was... the situation for Jack Lynch was that he had to prevent what was happening in the end. He might have did at certain times,
mm-hmm.
or it was a very difficult situation, but at the end of the day, he had to protect the state and protect the government.
But the crux again comes to the fact that Jim, your father, the Minister for Defence at the time, you're a relatively young man as well, and a lot of them were very young.
Yes.
With a young family as well, I'm conscious of that. And living in Kilkenny and travelling, and all those other pressures that we forget about people's, our politicians' lives in particular. But the crux is that the narrative is now down to 50 years later, and the narrative all along has been either Haughey and Blaney were going to import arms.
Mm-hmm.
That's generally agreed. Haughey and Blaney argued that it wasn't a conspiracy on the part of Haughey and Blaney. It was a government decision instructed to, well, the army came into this as well, by the Minister for Defence, Jim Gibbons, from Jack Lynch, that it was a government conspiracy rather than a Haughey-Blaney conspiracy.
That absolutely was not the case. Absolutely was not the case. I mean, there were very difficult situations in, as we all know, in the north in 1969. Mm-hmm. It was an appalling situation for the Catholics in the north, absolutely appalling. And you can imagine, particularly those close to it, you know, emotions ran high and what will we do to support people? Very delicate situation. And, you know, there was a subcommittee in the cabinet set up to manage a fund that would support people in the north. And I think there were four cabinet ministers who took responsibility for that fund. And I think it was Neil Blaney, Charles Haughey, Pádraig Faulkner, and I think the other man, I think he's Brennan, I'm not sure, I can't remember.
Yeah, Joe,
he was Minister for Labour at the time. Now, none of them were aware. Pádraig Faulkner and Brennan were not aware of the withdrawals in December 1969. So
the financial withdrawals.
No, the financial withdrawals.
To buy the guns,
Now, the money wasn't set up to buy guns, okay? The money was set up to support Catholics in
the north. That, I know that, but wasn't... The argument is that the money was being used to buy guns.
That is the argument.
Illegally by Haughey and Blaney.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, it's kind of used now that the February directive retrospectively gave permission for that. The February directive, the army directive in February, was to provide, if it needed, what supports were required, and if that was arms in a doomsday situation, not imported arms, or, you know, what happened eventually. But, you know, if it required in the north, in a doomsday situation, to help prevent a violent situation, that the army would support what was going on in the north. There was never a question in that February, and nobody can even imply that from that directive that gave some permission for money to be withdrawn.
But wasn't that what the trial pivoted on?
Yes.
And that evidence was given by the head of military intelligence, Michael Heffron, he was there and
he was retired at that point.
Yeah, but he said that your father, the Minister for Defence, came into the Chief of Staff and then into him and said, prepare for, this was February 1970, February the 6th, I think. He was saying, prepare for an invasion of certain parts of Northern Ireland. And such was the import of what your father said to the two senior army personnel that in the corridor afterwards, the Chief of Staff turned around to Michael Heffron and said, did you hear what I hear, or words to that effect? Go into your office now and write down exactly what you heard, because this is momentous.
I dispute that. I absolutely dispute that. I don't have the details of the. All I know is that that was never the intention of the February directive. There was very little contact between Heffron and he was not reporting even to his own chief of staff.
That's your belief. Is there any? Did your dad leave any contemporaneous documentation?
Yes, we have loads of it, and nobody's ever thought to see it. It's down in Kilkenny, and I'll tell you about that documentation.
Okay.
I have never really read through it all. I've seen some of it.
Okay.
After there was a book that came out during the summer, my own son, who's who's 22, mm-hmm. Who's studying history.
Great.
I found him sitting in a back room in our old family home, sitting on a chair with no desk, going through reams and reams of paper and scanning stuff, which he has gone through. There is mountains of stuff and his own personal notes. And I can tell you that even my 22-year-old could counter all of the current narrative on the situation.
And the current narrative is that that was a wider conspiracy, and that, to use the jargon, the phrase that I brought up the other day to telegraph things, because it was a lot of different people on who contacted the programme, that the narrative was that Haughey and Blaney were hung out to dry, and Heffernan and Jane, Captain James Kelly and John Kelly, they were hung out to dry because the government were caught with their hands in the arms dump, so to speak. And the other narrative is that it was a conspiracy much wider than Haughey and Blaney. It was a government-sanctioned decision to try and get arms into Northern Ireland.
Well, Joe,
they're the two conflicting narratives.
Yeah, and you know what? It is. And I'm not going to, you know, start criticising other people. I wasn't there. I was a young child, and I can understand high emotions, particularly people who are close to the north, right?
Of course, yeah.
But the plan, even in the Baileybur meeting in the previous year, 1969, that there was none of that came from government. And in fact, you know, as far as I'm aware...
This is when it was alleged that Captain James Kelly, who's a captain of military intelligence, met members of the IRA in Baileybur. Okay.
That's right. Not all of who agreed with his plan. And that's what we know now.
Okay. Now, back to the papers, Elizabeth. I presume from what you say, and your son, who's a 40-year history student, which is brilliant, at third level, like, you realise the importance of those documents, the historical importance. Are they contemporaneous notes by your dad, or are they documents that would be available in the state papers in the National Archive?
He has his own papers now. I'd like you to talk to maybe Harry and my own nephew, mm-hmm. James Gibbons, about more, who has researched it in depth, the whole thing. He's gone through military archives, he's gone through everything.
Yeah. But I'm saying those archives are widely available to historians.
Our papers are not.
And would you make them available?
Well, yes, but nobody's ever asked for them, and nobody... Now, I do know, from our point of view, we will be using them for our own purposes, okay? And you can understand, yeah. I suppose, Joe, that at this stage, a little bit of lack of trust sets in, probably because when my father, who is the most honest, truthful person of the highest integrity, when there people are questioning his, you know, truthfulness at the time, and continues to this day, causes such huge hurt to my family, to my siblings, but also it continues to this generation, the new generation, who are that bit removed from it, but it has had a deep impact.
You're saying your son Harry, he would have been reading, maybe in second level or whatever, about the arms trial, and he would have been reading that his grandfather was a traitor.
Yes.
In some narratives.
It's very difficult for me, because he would have been reading independently.
Yeah, of
because
course.
That
yes.
sort of,
yes,
you know
great.
What?
Brilliant.
There's a number of the grandchildren... and most of the grandchildren, or the majority of them, are sons, or grandsons, who would have been doing their own reading. Mm-hmm. And then you have to come back and say, well, Harry, there's another, you know...
Another side, okay.
Yes.
Okay. And, but you're saying you have evidence. Like your father was a famous, was a well-known caricaturist. He was a very good artist, very good caricature, which is a very difficult form of art. But anyway, he's well-known as being a very good caricaturist. In other words, he took up a pen and he wrote down things and he doodled with a pen and was better than doodling. But did he take up a pen and write down, this is what I remember happened this day. This is what I said to Charlie High. This is what I said to Niamh.
Probably not in the depth. He was more reflective. Probably not in the.
Well, did he ever consider writing a memoir?
He did, but he was. He it was his wish to do something before he died. Mm-hmm. But he was in very poor health for many years, so that didn't happen.
And would the family now commit it to a book?
Yes.
Okay, that's in the pipeline.
It was not. I mean, it will happen.
Okay,
and it'll probably be through the younger generation.
Okay, well, that's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. But please, 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 and you know this from what you say, make sure those papers are kept in fire. You know, generally, anyway, this is, and they're so valuable. Keep them safely, and if you have a fireproof filing cabinet, you know, and a floodproof thing, they're so important. I'm sure universities would cry out for them.
There are, but there's also a personal story in the whole thing.
Of course. Well, tell us about that personal story afterwards, because there's a famous one. We'd play this clip because your father got a pretty rough time afterwards. I know he stayed in government under Jack Lynch, and he subsequently became a very successful minister, a very well-regarded minister for agriculture, given his own farming background. And he went to the EU as well as a senior representative from Ireland. But this is your dad. It just gives people listening who mightn't be aware of the extent of the depth of what went on 50 years ago. And as I said, resonates to this day on this island and will in the next few months to an even greater effect with the Brexit deal or no deal, as it looks like.
Yes.
This is your father, and you get a sense of his upset talking in the Fianna Fáil Ard Fhéidir, I think, in 1971.
I stand by every living word I said. I did not pledge my word to Fianna Fáil. I didn't pledge my word to you. I pledged my word to God. Let no man call me a liar.
I think he goes on to say, I'm not a traitor.
You must remember...
God, you can feel the upset. You can hear the upset.
It was a horrendous time, Joe. And you know those sorts of situations where there are powerful people in every organisation, in every school, whether it's young people, whether it's you know, in big families, and where some people are quieter, some people, you know, there can be some people are afraid of more powerful people. It can be bullying. And if something then, a situation, I suppose, gets out of control or something, as in happened with the arms trial situation, people retreat. And very often, I've seen it, and particularly in my own work, where people get left isolated.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And my father was an accidental politician, right? He enjoyed it. He enjoyed a couple of things about politics. He enjoyed his constituents, the local people in Kilkenny, the stories, the fun, the problems. You know, he was a quiet, sensitive man, funny, loved storytelling, loved people and the stories and, you know.
And very erudite and very, he was in many ways a self-educated man in the classics and history. And he seemed to have enormous, that word is on the radio all the time, enormous curiosity about history and life. And
yes, and you could see it even with as a child, you know, if I was doodling something or whatever. He'd look over your shoulder with an expression of, you know, joy and curiosity, you know, and it sticks with you. The other thing he liked about politics were his portfolios. So he was in the Board of Works.
The OPW, as we know.
Absolutely adored. He was Parlisec junior minister. You know, doing work on historical buildings, our heritage. Absolutely adored it. And Charles Haughey was the senior minister as Minister for Finance. They were both had similar interests in history. They were both intelligent.
Okay.
My father looked up to him. He was an intelligent man.
Okay.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but also, I suppose, Dad had voted for George Colley.
Yeah, the leadership against
and
her.
And I suppose Jack Lynch was seen as an interim sort of leader. But
did your father ever talk about Charles Haughey afterwards? Because Sean Haughey told us 2 days ago that Jack Lynch's name could not be mentioned in their house in Abbeville after the arms trial.
Well, I'll tell you, my father was, he, unfortunately for himself, he internalized issues, okay? It had a huge impact on him. He didn't go around moaning about it day to day. You just had to see it, okay? The younger members of my family who are at home would have had a very different experience growing up to the older members who had lots of fun, and Dad was great to get them outside and doing all sorts of things. We're a big family. We could have made a cabinet the size of our family.
Okay. You're saying the elder part of the cabinet saw the real Dad, the lively, engaging, and the younger element, the parliamentary side, the younger element of the cabinet, saw a completely different man.
Well, a man who was troubled and who had to, you know, who felt quite isolated. Nowadays, of course, you know, you'd probably go and chat to someone, you know, or whatever.
Nowadays, what you, and this is not to take away from anyone who suffers from that awful condition, nowadays you'd call it depression.
Probably, yes. Yes. And when you internalize those things, it comes out physically.
Yeah.
You know. But then
he was attacked when Charlie Haughey was elected Taoiseach. He was beaten up out in the precincts of the Dáil. A shocking, shocking scene in any democracy.
Yeah, and that was the public face of that. We all saw that, and it was absolutely horrendous. But now I'm getting older. Say I was what, 5 or 6 at the time of the arms thing, right? And then I'm growing up in the 70s, and it's difficult, right? And then we have the elections of the early 80s, right? The intimidation, it was absolutely appalling, the levels that they went to get him out of his seat. It was scary.
And you mean Fianna Fáil?
Yes.
Yes, his own party.
Yes.
Yes.
And I'm not going to go into that too much at length.
Okay.
But I was young. I can speak to it from my own point of view. So I'm 16 or 17, right? I'm now canvassing. It was, and we'd be reporting back to, you know, our base at the end of the day with all the friends. It was terrifying. And that's the part that nobody would see.
And was it terrifying from members of Fianna Fáil?
Yes.
And what were they saying about your dad? Was it back to
that? If you don't mind, I could go into that at length, but I really...
Okay.
I would probably have to, you know, it was the a lot was done.
Okay.
And to get him out.
And it was obviously deeply upsetting to you and your family, your
brothers. Because my father wasn't made of that stuff. He wouldn't be probably a politician today, Joe. There was no advisors. He wasn't a PR man. He wouldn't have been good in working in advertising, I can tell you. That wasn't the makeup. I see it. I mean, I see it in some of his grandchildren, about 3 of them who are like replicas.
Straight talkers.
Absolutely. No, they just can't. I see it in one of my own. They just... and they're highly sensitive.
Now, there's another new book out today. I know you were talking about the Michael Heaney book, which is based on available historical records in UCD or the National Archives or whatever. But there's another book out today by David Bourke, and it's called Deception and Lies, and it's about the arms trial. Now, the thesis in this book, as far as I haven't seen it yet, but as far as I can find out, the thesis in this book is that it agrees with Michael Heaney's thesis, and that is that the government knew about the decision to import arms, all of the government, and Haughey and Blaney, etc., and James Kelly and Junk were hung out to dry. But it goes further, and it says that Peter Berry, who was the very powerful secretary of the Department of Justice, who rumbled the whole conspiracy and seemed to have, whether he revealed it to Jack Lynch or put Jack Lynch in the corner. Basically, David Bourke is saying, why was it, while the Irish Army were fully involved in the operation to import arms, the Department of Justice and Garda Intelligence were left out of the loop. David Bourke's new book on the arms crisis, I'm reading from Village magazine, but vital piece of the jigsaw into play. Why was it that while the Irish Army was involved, as the Department of Justice were not? David Bourke, for the first time, explains why Berry and the Special Branch moved to close down what, as a matter of political and historical fact, was a legitimate operation of the state approved by the Taoiseach. Now, you can contest that, a number of people contest that. And basically, they say the reason is that Sean McStiffon, the first chief of staff at the provisional wing of the IRA, played the special branch, in other words, was a special branch informer, to damage Goulding's Marxist wing of the IRA and perhaps to split and corrupt history's view of Fianna Fáil. So there's another thesis.
Well, that, another thing that we'll have to look at. But I can I know that my father had the first time my dad met Kelly was in March 1970.
This is Captain James Kelly.
James Kelly. Do you have to remember, Joe, that Captain Kelly, and I'm not having a go at Captain Kelly, I mean, a lot of these things are about power and money, and he's not someone who is in the position of power, you know. He was reporting not to the Minister of Defence or to the Taoiseach. He was reporting to the Minister for Agriculture.
It was Neil Blaney at the time.
Like, Joe, just think about that. I can't even remember who is the Minister for Agriculture now. There have been so many of them. But think of an issue like that. I think it's McConnellogue.
The current minister is, from Donegal. I was trying to work out in my head who was the Minister of Agriculture after your dad, but anyway.
Now, can you imagine huge significance like that being that the Minister for Agriculture, the people who in their own organisation, the Irish Army, weren't even reporting to their own. Colonel Delaney, who took over from Captain Heffron.
Colonel Heffron, yeah.
Wasn't informed either by Heffron, Colonel Heffron, or by Captain Kelly of their activities.
Okay.
And there was a meeting which my dad, Neil Blaney invited Dad to a meeting. Don't ask me what the purpose of the meeting was in April or May, or March or April in 1970. And he walked into the meeting, and there sitting are the retired Colonel Heffron, and Captain James Kelly, and the Minister for Agriculture. Do you see what I'm saying?
The
chain of command was totally fractured. It was unorthodox. It was bizarre.
And what subsequently happened was horrific on this island. 4,000 people, just short of 4,000 people died. So horrific that we don't even know the full figure. But it's much greater than the 3,500 that's previously believed. I believe from my own research about Frey and McClemens, about the children who were killed in the Troubles. 4,000 people died.
Yes.
The country was divided. The Provisional IRA were set up. The British Army hunkered down. The Stormont government collapsed. The British government didn't seem to know what it was doing at any particular time, especially when Thatcher was in power, just to criminalise the political situation. But it goes on and on and on, even to this day. Now, what did the family of Jim Gibbons want, Elizabeth?
What do we want now?
Yes.
I suppose from our point of view, we'd like a bit of balance and to be heard.
Okay.
My father wasn't heard. It kills me that, and he was unable to do it for himself in latter years. He was destroyed, Joe. I mean, after that episode in the Dáil, he had a heart attack after that.
When he was manhandled outside.
And his health deteriorated after that. I mean, there are some people, and they're blessed, that can cope with those things, you know, that be quite resilient in the face of all those things. And there's others that it has a huge impact on. and he was one of those. He had lots to give. He had such a mind. He was musical. He loved people. He was clever. If he had stayed, he was a highly innovative farmer.
I heard about that, yeah. In Kilkenny, yeah.
And not only that, and that's the part that he loved about working as in the Board of Works and about working as Minister for Agriculture, and that he loved when he was in Europe. He loved new experiences, new people, new ideas.
Okay.
That's the sort of person he was. If you look at his life, Joe, afterwards, or the life, his own life, is there anything that shows you about Jim Gibbons' life that he had any desire for power or money?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not there, Joe.
And I see that. Is there half a sentence missing there, Elizabeth? Are you thinking about Charlie High?
Well, I don't want to go down into the route of looking at everybody lives their own life.
But I come
right?
back to my original opening line, which I know jarred you, which is Justice Henchy saying, somebody is lying to me in this courtroom, and it's either Jim Gibbons or Charlie Haughey. And then he went on, the jury went on, by the way, to acquit Charlie Haughey. So the inference was.
I'll go back to the court case to the trial, and I told you what he had to experience and how grueling it was for him.
Did he ever talk to Charlie Haughey subsequently? Did they ever reconcile? Or
I doubt that. But I will tell you,
because your father was unwell for a while. I wonder, did Mr. Haughey ever contact him to say?
No. And do you know what? They could have. I mean, and also those people. Charlie was leader of Fianna Fáil for long enough, and Taoiseach. They could have sorted out Captain Kelly's grievances.
Okay.
He had a part to do that.
Okay.
I mean, it was Charles Haughey and Neil Blaney that Captain Kelly had to report to.
But you're saying from the family's reading, and you're talking about your son, who's a historian at this stage, nearly just about to qualify with 4 years. That's on the verge of having a master's degree. But you're saying on the family's reading of your Jim Gibbons papers, he will be the story that Jim Gibbons did not know of this conspiracy to import arms would stand.
Of course. I mean, a lot of it, at the end of the day, people will believe what they want to believe.
Because it's time has passed, and it's one of the reasons I now realise over the last few days why this issue was taken off on Liveline, because it's 50 years. Because time has passed, there are papers available, and I really think the Gibbons family should marshal those papers. Trust your own family to deal with them, obviously, but also trust one of the reputable, and they're all reputable, from the National Archives to the UCD to Trinity to various, the Franciscans keep an archive, various, and they're qualified archives of us who have no axe to grind, and keep them safe, but above all keep each other safe, Elizabeth, in these awful times. I appreciate the contact from the family
thank
of
you.
Jim Gibbons.
I want to say thank you very much to you, Joe, for getting in touch.
May your father rest in peace, and your mother, by the way. I asked everyone else, and it's only fair for me I asked everyone else involved in this, how did your mother manage afterwards?
My mother was a strong person, but it was very, very tough on her. Very, very tough.
Okay, Elizabeth Gibbons, thanks indeed. Thank you very much, Joe.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.